show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop renewal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here we are, the last Friday of 2012. This is the 28th of December, 2012. This is the Horn, headonradionetwork.com. A website that presently has some problems, but those problems are being sorted out and fixed by the intrepid team of John Fox and Ben Birch. It appears we've been hit again. I don't know, do we take that as a sort of backhanded compliment? Anyway, it will get sorted out. Nothing to fear, nothing to worry about. Stream's working fine. Everything's going right out there. All good. The Horn is available not just at headonradionetwork.com, but at TuneIn Radio, tunein.com, for which there is a smartphone app you might want to make use of. If you get the premium version of TuneIn.com, you can even record the program on your own device, which could come in handy. You can also get an app for Stitcher or for Tuner Internet Radio or for, there's a lot of them out there. The stream is available at dar.fm and streama.com and on Roku devices. The podcast address for later listening is at whiterosesociety.org under the Bob Kincaid subdomain. Of course, you can also get the podcast at iTunes. Used to be you could also listen live at iTunes, but they delisted us for something, some reason. Pisses me off. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This, like I said, is The Horn. And this is an entirely listener-supported effort. We try to raise $150 a month. Overnight, we raised $10 of last night's amount, which puts us in a bit of a spot as we head toward the end of the month and the end of the year. But we will soldier on as long as we can. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com, or if there's a problem with that, you can simply use the address that is tied to bobkincaid@gmail.com. bobkincaid@gmail.com. Now, had everything ready to go for a show this evening, of course. It is Friday on the front porch. And we are all a titter, I suppose. No, we're not. Over the fiscal thing that is so nearly flat as to barely be able to qualify as an incline. A moody President Obama just addressed the nation for a few minutes right before showtime, talking about trying to get something hammered out in the Congress and saying that he had asked and that the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid had agreed that there will be a bill introduced for the most essential elements of relief if a larger plan cannot be reached. It's that larger plan that worries me, because there were not any details of what that larger plan entails. Look out. Be awake. Be aware. Now, that having been said, who knows what they're doing up there. I'm guessing that, what time is it? Yeah, okay, it's 6:05 p.m. Washington, D.C. time. I figure John Boner's on about his third bottle of Merlot. And if it gets much worse, he's going to go to screw top stuff. And maybe have to put a straw in it. Yeah. Charlie Pierce over at Esquire's politics blog refers to the radical proto-hominids of the Republican Party, and particularly the teabag extreme, as being the feral children of the Republicans in the House. Yeah, sort of like, I don't know, Lord of the Flies, maybe? There's a fly in my wine, what? Right. But there's a show to be done tonight, one way or the other. It's Friday on the Front Porch. All things are open to discussion, cuss and discuss, as it were. A couple of things grabbed my attention early in the day. One was some information brought to my attention by our buddy Dr. John. Dr. John, in addition to being our archaeological consultant, is also our journalism consultant, having been a real-life journalist and having, studied this stuff. He's far more of one than I could ever claim to be because, among other things, I worked in radio, and it's really not somewhere you want to go for journalism. But Dr. John wrote in regarding last night's discussion of the CNN story about the posting of the names of the permit holders in those Hudson Valley communities of New York. And I think he offers some very worthwhile criticisms. So, without further ado, Dr. John's note. Last night on your show, you mentioned the story about the New York newspaper that published a map of handgun permits that had been issued in Westchester and Rockland counties. You spoke approvingly of this, and a couple of callers and emailers did as well. You even snarkily referenced some journalism professor somewhere who suggested this was a highly unethical thing to do. More on that in a minute. I'm going to give a little pushback on what seems to be a building left consensus about this particular story. I mean, from what I can tell, it's lefties who are saying good job and right-wing types who say this was wrong. In short, says Dr. John, I think both sides are framing this incorrectly. By way of explaining my take, I should note that I earned a degree in journalism, worked in the profession for 7 years at newspapers ranging from small town to statewide to national circulated, as well as a major cable news network. I have intimate connections to the company that owns the New York newspaper in question. I know how newsrooms work. I know how decisions to develop and publish a story like this are made, and I know what sort of information should be included to make a story like this effective and useful to readers. It's the last part where this story fails and actually hurts rather than advances the debate over handguns. And remember, of course, that the data in question did not concern who has an AR-15 or who has any particular sort of firearm, save for the fact that it was concealed carry permits, which sort of, default to handguns. That's me, not Dr. John. Dr. John continues, on the left, people seem to be saying this is a positive action taken in the public interest that functions as a sort of public shaming of gun owners and serves to warn people of potential threats in their community. There's a problem here. And with all due respect, it's an ethical one, with a couple of facets. First, there's no guarantee that having a handgun permit equals owning a handgun. Second, by virtue of how they were acquired, the data necessarily contains some level of inaccuracy. Each map lists people who have applied for or renewed a permit in the past 5 years. Some have undoubtedly moved away since then. Others, without a permit, have likely moved into addresses where the previous owner had one, and so on. Some draw a parallel to the publication of registered sex offender addresses. I have severe reservations about doing that, as do I, but let's table them for now. This parallel is specious. People acquire gun permits legally. In effect, this is a public shaming of people who have gone out of their way to follow the law. Where's the sense in that? See why I decided this had to... Yeah. Moreover, the argument goes, gun permits are a matter of public record, so the newspaper was well within its rights to publicize this. The simple fact is, newspapers never publish everything that is public record, and not everything that is public record warrants publication. When I bought my house, the sale was printed in the local newspaper. That's legitimate. It's part of the grammar of the newspaper, and it serves a public interest. When I got a building permit to add a pellet stove, however, that wasn't printed. It was public record, too, but divorced of any context. It was irrelevant. Tax bills are public record, but they're only published in the service of a larger contextualized story, say an article on failing city revenues with a listing of the largest delinquent landlords, not every single taxpayer's bill mapped by location and name. There's a common fallacy in the uncritical support of the New York paper's map, one that we often accuse the media of falling into, stenography. Newspapers do not exist to simply print data without context or reflection. Doing that does not serve the public interest, as we learned to our great horror during the Iraq War buildup. Justifying the publication of poorly contextualized, though publicly available data as a matter of record is intellectually dishonest for anyone who ever railed about shoddy reporting. That would be me. And this is shoddy reporting, Dr. John continues, and shoddy editing. As you know, editors do not simply shuffle commas around. They're responsible for ensuring a story is framed and contextualized. I often think about editing like the old story about the band that didn't want any green M&Ms in their dressing room. That would be Van Halen. The reason? If the venue crew could be counted on to take care that the detail of that detail, then they were probably also on top of the much more important electrical sound and effects stuff. Stuff that affects real human well-being and safety. The point is, when you miss the small editing details, you've probably also missed the big picture problems. For instance, the map in question in this story notes, permit holders who have died or moved out of the area may not have updated their permit records. Really? Dead permit holders may not have updated their records? A little warning that this story wasn't ready for prime time. What do I mean by that, Dr. John asks. I mean, there is a huge list of possible stories that could have been spawned by this handgun permit data, but the paper chose the easy, half-assed route. The permit data could have been collapsed by zip code, township, or, hell, even neighborhood. Then permit holders could have been compared to crime rates in that geographic area. It would have been interesting to see how handgun permits relate to the actual threat of crime. The data could have been historicized. Are permits in the counties increasing or decreasing over the past 10 years? And why might that be? The permit data could have been mapped according to distance to school zones. Here's an idea. It could have been cross-referenced by the aforementioned sex offender registry by parolees or people with convictions, and then I'd be all for printing names and addresses. I can guarantee you that the reason the story was published in the form it was, maps listing names and addresses of issued permits, is because it was easy. It was a simple matter of geo-referencing a database of gun permits. Going even a single step beyond that, forming the data into any of the stories I suggested above, or mapping the data more broadly in a way that concealed identities, would have taken another day or two by reporters assigned to this story and no other. That's a day or two that reporters and graphics people were not allowed. This is very important what comes next. I know this company, and I know how it has downsized and de-skilled its reporting staff, all while remaining quite profitable, of course. As for the right-wing objections, the biggest seems to be the papers given burglars a shopping list of houses to hit to steal guns. I don't generally put much stock in that objection, but it has currency with newspaper reporting. It's why we don't print home addresses in obituaries, for instance. There's at least a chance somebody might want to break into a house during the funeral, when it's empty. The bigger problem to me is the houses without permits. Isn't there at least a possibility that those houses might be targeted? At the very least, if I learned that my house was the only one on the street without a listed permit, wouldn't I consider getting one? That doesn't serve any legitimate public interest. To make a very long story short, I think this is an intensely problematic example of journalism gone wrong due to a poorly conceived idea that was then executed badly. Blame lies in less than adequate attention to ethics, along with structural problems in the corporate newspaper industry. Framing the story differently, contextualizing it in service of a more reflective article or series, would have both contributed to advancing the gun debate and removed the legitimate criticism of how this story was handled. Now, the criticism has become the story, rather than any of the issues the story raises. That's harmful for our side, and a missed opportunity. Pardon me while I call time out and ask, where in the for-profit media and terrestrial radio, where are you going to find as reasoned an explanation as that? It did turn out to be shoddy journalism. And it turned out to be a product of all the things that we do object to in the for-profit part of for-profit media. Naked data can be taken to mean any number of things. I still think, Dr. John went on to do some research on the Poynter Institute, and that's another journalism fail from CNN. It turns out, I saw Poynter Institute. I didn't see a university or a college name associated with it. It sounded like the typical expert that CNN is notorious for going out and getting, you know, somebody who got his credentials from the back of a matchbook. This is apparently not the case. As John went on and informed us, Poynter's not some fly-by-night outfit. It's a big, big deal. Based at the Medill Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern, the other claimant to best J school in the nation. You don't get to be on faculty at Poynter by filling out a response card or working as a Fox News shill for a year or two. I don't know this Al Tompkins guy, the guy who was quoted in the CNN story, but his bio is pretty impressive. He's won national Emmy and Peabody Awards for broadcast reporting, and he's on the selection committee for the Investigative Reporters and Editors Award. Also very big deals. So it sounds like he's got some street cred behind him and academic cred. I would suggest, however, that his argument that I like Dr. John's argument that if you're the only guy on the street that doesn't have one of these things, it might tend to make you think about wanting to go and get one, as opposed to professor or doctor or Mr. Poynter's argument that this just encourages people to, you know, these much vaunted law-abiding gun owners to go out and become firearm scofflaws. It should be remembered at the bottom level of this, these are concealed carry permits. These are people who want the right to carry a firearm under their coat when they go to buy a loaf of bread and peanut butter and jelly down to the Wally World. And everything that attends that debate that we discussed last night. This data could have been much more than it was, and I thank John very much for pointing out the broader implications of bad journalism. But more and more, I would dare say, bad journalism is what we can expect. From massive for-profit journalism outfits. So there's a little background, and I think it is badly needed. Because you know what? I've read a number of stories about this issue, and not one of them has included the level of detail that Dr. John provided me and you. That has to do with Dr. John's expertise and dedication to his craft. But it also has to do with the general whip people into a frenzy aspect of modern information presentation. Because you know this newspaper knew that the people who had the guns were going to go absolutely, who had the parts were going to go nuts. Now, the larger question remains. Because one of the portions of the conversation Susan and I had last night was, if little Timmy wanted to go and play at little Jimmy's house, are we now at a point in time where we ask whether little Jimmy's parents' home is an armed camp? And what does that do to social interaction? Is a concealed carry permit only valuable if it's a secret? That takes me to the discussion in Dr. Strangelove about the doomsday device. Why didn't you tell us you were building one? Because you are already building one. We're not. Where'd you get that idea?
We read it in the New York Times.
You get the idea. I have stepped in it with Dr. John. I referred to the Charlie Pierce's feral children of the House of Representatives as radical proto-hominids. Dr. Johnson. Unfair to proto-hominids. What would our Ardipithecus remedus say? Well, would he say anything, Dr. John? Or would it just be mostly a matter of the grunts, squeaks, and clicks? Then again, we could also be talking about Sunday meeting down at the Left Elbow Baptist Church. Never mind. With regard to the fiscal incline, Robert from Australia writes in, the Republicans and the teabaggers are going to be really popular with the rest of the world if they screw over the U.S. economy. As we all know, the U.S. economy is part of the world economy, and if the U.S. economy is bad, the rest of the world cops the fallout. What's the old saying? The U.S. sneezes and the world gets the flu. This is that.
But again, I come back, and I don't want to be repetitive and make one show just sound like the one before it. But you have a sizable number of the membership of the House of Representatives, and they largely come from Confederate states, who, consciously or un, are waging a mostly bulletless civil war against the rest of us. As I have mentioned before, I grew up seeing bumper stickers on the backs of rusted-out Chevrolets and busted-up Dodges up and down the roads of Alabama and Tennessee with one simple statement on it. The South will rise again. And these goobers believe it as an article of faith. And just as Nikita Khrushchev stood at the UN and banged on the podium with his shoe and said, "We will bury you." Well, some of that same mindset is more than easily observed in the congressional delegation from the old Confederacy and from Confederate wannabes in places like Oklahoma and Arizona and even some of the weirdos in California. And so, Robert and the rest of the rest of the international listenership, please understand that there are members of the House of Representatives under the Republican banner who would be thrilled not just to burn the American economy to the ground, but the whole world's. Who would be happy if there were soup lines with no soup at the end of the line? Who would be happy if bread lines had no bread? Because they are the most... they are the most die-hard of nihilists. If we can't run the show, ain't gonna be no show to run. They do not lose with grace, they do not lose with dignity, and they, by God, sure don't lose with honor. And they, well, what did Dr. Hunter S. Thompson say? They will travel on a road of bones. The hogs are in the tunnel, and they will travel on a road of bones. They are, and they do. And the bones are granny's bones and children's bones. The bones of octogenarian World War II veterans like let's at least remember his name. I'm looking for it here. Like a man named Thomas S. Anderson, 89 years old, who lived alone on the 13th floor in apartment C of building B in an apartment complex in Far Rockaway, Queens. Who died? For want of basic services, for want of attention, for want of food, medicine, infrastructure. You know, all those things the Republican Party despises. And was not found for a couple of weeks. The New York Times describes Mr. Anderson thusly: what can be said for certain is that he spent his last days largely alone in the dark, trapped high above the ground without heat, dependent on the haphazard goodwill of others for his survival. Because, you see, feral children don't care about things like this. Mr. Anderson projected cool well into his 80s, a tattooed, earring-wearing great-grandfather with a white Van Dyke mustache that curved into a goatee. He wore glasses and rarely left his apartment without a baseball cap or beanie and his clip-on yellow-tinted shades. He was a native of North Carolina, had worked in a post office and as a supervisor at Marlboro Books in Lower Manhattan, a chain acquired by Barnes & Noble. He once took tailoring classes to learn to make his own suits and loved baseball. He'd played with an old-timers club in Harlem called the Unknowns and watched or attended nearly every Mets game. He was an Army infantryman who had served in the Pacific during the Second World War and earned a number of decorations. He moved into the Roy Reuther houses in Far Rockaway, named after the brother of Walter Reuther of United Auto Workers fame. It was designed to provide decent housing for persons of modest means so that they could have some dignity in their existence. This is an idea that took shape in the 1970s. By the time Sandy rolled around, well, it had been repurchased, remonetized, and I guess we can say that Mr. Anderson was part of the liquidation. But these are the people that people like Louis Gohmert of Texas care about not a damn. But that is not necessarily where I wanted to go with the program this evening, because something else got under my skin as well. And, by the way, program note, on Monday, remember, please, on Monday, there will be a Horn Malloy Skype group chat, free-for-all discussion, as part of our New Year's Eve show. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. If you're not involved already and you want to be involved in the ongoing series of Friday night, Saturday night, as needed, Horn Malloy Skype chat groups, shoot me an email and I'll pass them along to the moderator, who is also a moderator in our chat room, the redoubtable Sparky. Indefatigable, even. I think that's the right use of redoubtable. But let me know, and of course the regular 304-658-3333 phone lines will be available as well. Now, before we move on to the rest of the program, I've got a note here from Don. He said, I'd like to make a $100 pledge challenge. I will match every donation until the $100 challenge is met. The offer is available until midnight, December 31st, 2012, Eastern Standard Time. That would go a long way toward picking up for last night and getting us on the way to tonight and then finishing out December the 31st. And like I said, I'm not even sure what the status of the website is right now, and not sure what impact that has. I'm trying to see how it loads. It loaded normally for me. But, you know, there's a PayPal button, and Don has graciously agreed to double your money up to $100 if you hit the PayPal button between now and New Year's Eve, or New Year's, midnight, December 31st. Thank you very kindly, Don. That helps more than you know. So that's all night tonight, or, well, hey, you know, maybe we'll get over the hump in this tonight. That'd be great. More bills we can actually put into the hat. And, of course, it also works by snail mail. The snail mail address is at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute. If you'd rather just write it down, it's The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower, like the President, Drive, PMB, Personal Mailbox, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, WV, 25801. And a reminder for those who prefer the snail mail route, checks, money orders, whatever, do not make them payable to Bob Kincaid, as Bob Kincaid does not get the money. Please make them payable to The Horn or Head On Communications or something like that. And that way the folks at the credit union don't go, who the hell is Bob Kincaid? What? No. The Horn or Head On Communications, Head On Radio Network. But just not my name. No, I said earlier that something kind of got under my skin today. This morning, as a matter of fact. And I think it would be at least an interesting discussion. The news broke yesterday that Sonia Sotomayor, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, acting for the Supreme Court as a body, rejected a request by that fine, upstanding, Christian, Bible-believing, God-fearing corporation, Hobby Lobby. Now, you know, Hobby Lobby is where you go to get your crochet supplies, your knitting supplies, your macrame supplies, maybe your candle-making supplies, your scents and stuff for your odor burner thing on the light bulb, or your potpourri piddler, whatever. It's a crafts superstore. Glue guns, you know, staplers, felt. You get the idea. And of course, they're closed on Sunday, just like Chick-fil-A, and for the same reason. They want their employees to be down on their knees worshiping the Jeebus. So when the contraception mandate came,
came along, Hobby Lobby was in the vanguard of those objecting to the idea of insurance companies, especially their health insurance company, providing contraception at no copay to women who wanted it. So they sued, and they lost at the district court level, and they lost again at the appeals court level. So then they climbed up to the highest court in the land, and they asked for an injunction against the employer mandate until the full case could be heard. Injunctive relief is something that is granted, among other things, when irreparable harm will result to the petitioner if the injunction is not granted. Well, the way the Supreme Court works, it rotates as to who hears these emergency petitions and emergency stays and things like that. And it was, in fact, Sonia Sotomayor's turn. And I'm a little bit heartened by her decision, because she is, after all, a hardcore Roman Catholic, as are Justice Scalia and Thomas and Roberts and Kennedy. And who am I missing? Scalia, Slappy, Alito, Deadeye, Kennedy. I think that, yeah. And so on an issue of birth control, that she came to the right conclusion was at least moderately inspiring. Because she said, no. No. You can't have an injunction because you can't meet the burden of proof. Now, that's not to say that Hobby Lobby lost their case. The case has not yet been heard, let alone decided. But Hobby Lobby, it now appears obvious, holds itself above the law. You know, a lot of years ago, as the end of the Second World War in Europe was being contemplated, Winston Churchill had a conversation with Joseph Stalin. And he was telling Stalin all about how the British entered the Second World War in order to protect Poland against the invasion by Hitler, and Poland's Catholicism meant a lot to them, and they were a very Catholic country, and he wanted to make sure that the three allied nations, the U.S., Great Britain, and the Soviet Union, would respect the rights of the Polish, blah blah blah, and their deep heritage of Roman Catholicism. And Churchill was fulminating on, as Churchill was bound to do. And Stalin stopped him and said, "How many divisions does the Pope at Rome command?" In other words, signaling to Stalin that he didn't give a damn about anything that Churchill had said. And so we find today that Oklahoma City-based Hobby Lobby has decided to take a Stalinist stand where the laws of the United States of America are concerned. Really, not kidding. Hobby Lobby has declared
that even though it did not get the injunction that it asked for, even though the injunction was legally and properly denied, that it is going to refuse to follow the law of the United States of America, and that it is going to refuse to provide the mandated contraceptive coverage to women under the Affordable Care Act that begins on January the 1st. Kyle Duncan is general counsel of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, one of these phony baloney right-wing legal think tanks that takes the position that every time somebody serves a preacher a cold cup of coffee, persecution has taken place. He said, they're not going to comply with the mandate. They're not going to offer coverage for abortion-inducing drugs in the insurance plan. Abortion-inducing drugs. Never mind the fact that what is at issue is the pill. Never mind the fact that the pill is not an abortion-inducing drug. If you could prove that scientifically with charts and graphs and 8x10 color glossy photographs with circles and arrows on the back of each one, right there in front of the fundamentalist face of the Taliban Christian who runs Hobby Lobby, wouldn't make any difference. Jesus done talked to him, you see. And Jesus done told him that them filthy women folk need to stop disobeying the Lord God, and they need to get pregnant every time they make the beast with two backs. Every time they get themselves naked and filthy, and somebody crawls atop them, the result needs to be a pregnancy. And they don't need to be taking no pills to keep it from happening. In essence, Hobby Lobby responded to the Supreme Court of the United States by saying, and how many divisions does the Supreme Court control? This is a wealthy, and I do mean wealthy, corporation. How wealthy? Well, you might recall Hobby Lobby from a previous story going back to, 2007 or so. 2007 was when Richard Roberts and his wife, Richard being the dutiful son of Oral Roberts, that's when the story broke that, well, they were living large as the head of Oral Roberts University. I seem to recall that there was a story out there, among other things, about Mrs. Roberts texting young college students and, you know, a little slap and tickle, a little canoodling, you know, fornicating like you're supposed to get stoned for in the Bible, and we're not talking about the good kind of stoned. Take this into account when I give you the details of what will happen when Hobby Lobby defies we, the people of the United States, who are actively engaged in trying to form a more perfect union. It was back in 2007 when all the canoodling went on, and Oral Roberts University was quickly going toenails up. Back then, a story from the Tulsa World read as follows. Oral Roberts University, whose namesake founder told believers to expect a miracle, received an offer of $70 million of a $70 million bailout this past Tuesday if the school will reform its practices. The money would be enough to wipe out a massive debt troubling the school, but the offer by a Yukon, Oklahoma businessman only after Oral Roberts' son Richard Roberts had to leave the ORU presidency. Mart Green, that's M-A-R-T, Mart. Mart Green, whose family founded the Hobby Lobby chain of craft stores, promised the gift provided the university shows good governance of its finances. Green said at an ORU press conference that his family already gave the university $8 million to address immediate financial needs. That was probably the buyout of Richard Roberts. After a 90-day review process, the remaining $62 million will be donated, provided, now this is back in 2007, provided that the review's findings are mutually satisfactory to both parties. Green has no previous connection to ORU, but he called the school God's College. ORU must restore its broken trust, its battered reputation, and its beaten spirit. Richard Roberts resigned Friday as ORU's president following allegations in a lawsuit that he and his family misspent university and ministry money. The resignation apparently was the key to Green's donation decision, which he said he made recently after following news coverage of ORU's troubles. When we saw Richard Roberts resign on Friday, that was the door that we said, all right, that was the leadership issue that has been taken care of. We'll be looking at the financial things, the legal things, the lawsuits and all that. We'll do a complete business review. The answers of this, the assets of this organization are its students, its faculty, and its alumni. And we said we do not want to see this organization going down, and we are going to answer the call. $70 million. To prop up a right-wing, evangelical diploma mill. Yeah, $70 million. Just didn't even think about it. That's 5 years ago. The Green family have instructed their insurance carrier not to follow the law of the United States of America and provide cost-free contraception to women. They will face a fine of something like $1.3 million per day. For not doing so. They didn't bat an eyelash at $70 million to prop up a diploma mill. How much do you think they're worried about some pissant $1.3 million fine? They're expecting a miracle. They're going to believe, hallelujah, glory. And you know what? Since they're Christians, they're most likely liars. They're probably going to sit and argue because they've got a lawyer from the Beckett Fund. You know, named for Thomas A. Becket, the guy who tried to subvert the King of England in the name of the church, who wanted the church to rule England instead of its king. Yeah, the Becket Fund will argue that they should. Oh, by making them pay that demonic fine under that demonic communist socialist Kenyan Muslim anti-colonialist Affordable Care Act. That's the mark of the beast. And it would be sinful and a violation of the Green Family Corporation's First Amendment rights to make them obey the law of the United States of America. Because they, see, brothers and sisters, they obey a higher law. A law whose speaker only they can hear, don't you know?
Yeah. Because the head of an outfit that sells craft supplies knows what women need better than women themselves. God, this bunch disgusts me. Wouldn't it be nice if they could just go out of business and take their millions and go found a church somewhere and roll on the floor or speak in tongues or handle serpents or cast out demons? That's what we're trying to do, Bob. We're trying to cast the demons out of the Supreme Court of the United States. Jesus. I mean, we don't want to reward women after all because, you know, they're all born with that original sin of Eve about them. Oh, she was a nasty tramp, that Eve was. Eating on that fruit. No, Eve, no, crunch. Oh, really, it's good. Try it. Adam, have you eaten of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil?
Well, yes, God.
Did I not tell you not to eat of the fruit of... Oh, wait a minute. Did I not tell you not to eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, Adam?
Oh, yeah.
Then, Adam, why did you eat from the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil?
That woman made me. She done it, God. She's the one. She's over there talking to the snake, and the snake was talking to her, and she said, dang, this sure is good. You want to buy it? And I said, well,
Yeah. Because of that, the Greens, who bailed out a diploma mill, and what would that 70, I mean, I don't mean to bust out all disciple-y or anything on anybody, but what would that $70 million have done? Oh, for the homeless in the state of Oklahoma, or the hungry in the state of Oklahoma, or the naked in the state of Oklahoma, or the imprisoned in the state of Oklahoma. Because, see, there's all kind of, those are the people that Jesus, Yeshua, you know, the guy that they worship as, you know, their zombie god, that's all the stuff that he told them actually mattered. You've done it unto the least of these, you've done it also unto me. In that list of naked and hungry and homeless and in prison and sick, there wasn't nothing there about propping up no diploma mills. God. But they know better. They know better than the legislative body of the United States. They know better than the executive branch of the United States. And they sure as hell know better than some woman with a name they can't pronounce on the Supreme Court who's only there because she's a violating God's law and being on a lawyer and on the court and judging and stuff, when everybody knows that that women are supposed to be at home, not ask questions in church, for that is shameful. Right? Right. Make me sick. David Green offered a statement as to why he was going to thumb his nose at we the people. Our family is now being forced to choose between following the laws of the land that we love. Bullshit. You don't love this land. You love your money. And you love your weirdo fundamentalist religion. Or maintaining the religious beliefs that have made our business successful and supported our family and thousands of our employees and their families. We simply cannot abandon our religious beliefs to comply with this mandate. Their religious beliefs had nothing to do with the success of their business. Their business model, which had nothing to do with their religion, had to do with the success of their business. The fact that it's a giant box store and all the little local craft stores in the communities where they come into go out of business because they can undercut them on pricing. And yea, verily, Jesus did say unto them, never pay retail. No, it's not in there either. That's what contributed to the success of their business. Their relentless, remorseless pursuit of money led to the success of their business. The Green Fan, this is from the Oklahomastanian or something. I guess it's out of Oklahoma City. The Green family's operation of Hobby Lobby and Mardell retail stores. Mardell! Bring me some buttermilk and cornbread, then get back in the kitchen, would you? Retail stores has long reflected their evangelical Christian beliefs. The business closes its shops on Sundays. Glory. Annually buys full-page religious newspaper ads on Easter and Christmas. Hallelujah. And employs full-time chaplains to minister to workers. Oh, my God, can you imagine having to work at Hobby Lobby? There's a full-time chaplain? I'm sorry, what? Now, sister? Sister Ardetha, you don't need to go out and smoke one of them heathen cigarettes. You just come right over here on your break. You just come right over here and pray with me. We'll get that demon cigarette smoking out of you. The Greens regularly funnel corporate profits to Christian ministries and missions. Jesus, and you thought, ew, you thought Chick-fil-A was icky. I told you they weren't going to pay. The lawsuit seeks a temporary injunction to allow the company to avoid the potential fines when its insurance plan year begins January 1st. The lawsuit also seeks a permanent injunction prohibiting the mandate's enforcement against the Green family and its businesses and other individuals and organizations that object on religious grounds to provide an insurance coverage for abortion causing drugs and devices and related education and counseling. You could slap them right down on the abortion-causing part of it. Interesting, though. What will this do to the insurance company? Does the insurance company have a right to provide it anyway? Does an employee have a right to sue the Greens? Is there a woman out there of childbearing years with enough courage to sue these theistic, theocratic Taliban thugs? And they go on and on and on, operating on the sort of Goebbels model that if you tell the same lie long enough, it'll become the truth.
Lawyer Duncan said, to remain true to their faith, it is not their intention as a company to pay for abortion-inducing drugs. Abortion-inducing drugs appears in this news story three times with not a single piece of information refuting the idea that they are abortion-inducing drugs, which is a wholesale lie. Government attorneys have argued that for-profit corporations such as Hobby Lobby and Mardell, get my slippers, are secular entities, and that the contraceptive pills and devices were included among other forms of contraception under the health care law because medical experts deemed them necessary for women's health and well-being. This ain't no 501c3 tax-exempt organization, although if they could get away with it, don't you think for a minute that they wouldn't be. Right? Yeah. So, that's the first hour. That's the filibobster. Email coming in from Tamara. Thanks, Bob, for mentioning that there are right-wing weirdos in California, too. Something I've been meaning to write about, but just haven't gotten around to, relates directly to the discussion you were having with Carol the other night. As far as I know, the very first school shooting took place very near my house by someone my own age, just a couple of years older than you. It was done by Brenda Spencer, a high school girl who had received a rifle for Christmas. The event took place in 1979 and was memorialized in a song by the Boomtown Rats called I Don't Like Mondays. The shooting was followed in 1984 by the McDonald's Massacre. A guy who left a note about hunting humans picked off some kids on bicycles, among many others, near the San Diego-Tijuana border. That event was followed in 1996 by the San Diego State Massacre, my alma mater. Then there were the two school shootings within 3 weeks from each other in 2001 at Santana High School and then Granite Hills High School, both of which were in the same district as the high school I attended. So sadly, I have grown up with school shootings as an ever-present reality. California is not the liberal paradise some would make it out to be. There is a monument to the victims of the first shooting less than a block from where I live today. So thanks again for referencing my reality. By the way, the liquor store on the corner got robbed 1 week ago tonight by two guys with two guns. The cops said it was one of the seven that happened just that night. Sheesh. Oh, by the way, a little bit of good news. We are halfway toward meeting Don's challenge. We need five more folks at $10 apiece, and we'll be there. We'll have it lit before, not only before midnight, but before the end of the show. So thank you very kindly. Well, let's not shilly-shally, frilly-frally about. Never mind the bumper music and stuff. Let's go straight away to the phones. You know, the lines are open, 304-658-3333, and we go thence now. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Bob, it's Carol in Vegas.
Oh, a conjugate, or Tamara conjugate.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just, I couldn't help but just call you real quick. You were talking, was it yesterday? I was listening to the show and about Mitt Romney to try to make him look human.
Oh, that was a couple of nights ago, yeah.
He helped a 14-year-old ride a well?
Yeah, that's, yeah.
I really couldn't believe what I was hearing when you said that. Because, obviously, this was no average 14-year-old. And I think you probably, there could be really only two possibilities that this 14-year-old, Mitt Romney wanted to make sure that the Mormon Church got their 10% of the fortune, and or that his parents were so wealthy that they were sheltering some of their money and their children somehow in trust. Right?
Those were the two that occurred to me, yeah.
Okay. Well, I was just...
Because I didn't see Willard going to his bedside to help him write down where he wanted his baseball glove and baseball card collection to go.
Well, I just think that speaks such volumes about not only who the Romneys are and what they're involved in, and I guess even as bad as it is right now, possibly the bullet we dodged from him. But it just speaks to the much bigger question of mega wealth and what kind of perversion occurs in maintaining that mega wealth, to where even the bishop of a church, if you want to call the Mormon a church, but anyway,
right,
that he's going to make sure that money, that huge amount of money, is protected from ever being distributed to where it could do any good, which is very common, obviously, with very wealthy people. And I, you know, when I just called in, you were talking about something about the Green family and their problems. I didn't catch it all.
Yeah, Hobby Lobby and you know, they're going to openly defy the Supreme Court's order that they pay for no-cost contraception for their employees.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, you know, I can't believe that you didn't get a lot of emails from people when this whole Romney thing was brought up, because, you know, I've heard a lot of things in my lifetime, but a 14-year-old that has the kind of massive amounts of money that someone with the stature of Mitt Romney has to step into, it's almost like a mafia thing, only with the mafia of the elite, you know?
Right. And they behave like it too, Carol. But that was stunning enough. But what really sort of made my hair fly backwards in like in one of those old Maxell tape ads was this notion that the family desperately wanted this story put out there to the American public as proof of his common humanity.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's how out of touch they are. That's when you live in that high of an echelon of people and wealth, it's just a different world. It's completely different. You know, I read a book some time ago called The Societies of the American Elite. And what was interesting to me about it was that he started talking about how the early fortunes of the power families in this country, how far back they go and where they really came from. And so much of the money that is still being amassed today by relatively few people started out in piracy, human trafficking, and the opium trade. And that money, which started insurance companies and banking companies.
Yeah, what we would call today money laundering.
Exactly. But it goes back, and this whole thing with Romney, it got me thinking again about, you know, this type of thing where these fortunes all started through crime. And all of these big wealthy families, I mean, there might be an odd one here and there that weren't involved in it, but they all started from very bad starts. And it's so amazing how these wealthy people, they're always they're worried about crime and criminals getting their money, when all that money came from crime itself. And this thing with Mitt Romney just really got me thinking about that, how, you know, the fact that, like we talked about the other day, your children and their futures and their future opportunities being so limited by this economy and all this wealth being hoarded. And that's essentially what all this wealth and inheritance is. It steals the future of young people who are not born wealthy. And it started so long ago, you know?
And we still don't dare talk about the estate tax as a means of, and I mean, listen, Carol, you had to do it. I've had to do it. Everybody within the sound of my voice has had to do it. You go out and you make your own way in the world. And yet we still protect a fairly minuscule class of people who'd never have to lift a finger. Someone once said, get born on third thinking they done hit a triple.
Exactly.
You know, that's the Bush family.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Romneys.
Mm-hmm.
Lord knows. I mean, it's quite an impressive list. But why should the accident of birth And why should birth itself be a lottery? Over at the blog The Agonist the other day, there was a brilliant essay on America's gun lottery, in which we are all unwitting participants in a lottery that determines who will live and who will die in some horrid act of gun violence. But there is another lottery, and it's the birth lottery. And if you just happen to be lucky enough to be born a Bush or a Romney or any of these other hideous families, well, you're set. You're made. Look at that one number about the Walton heirs, for heaven's sakes. Those people have more money than some several countries.
Well,
I mean, what is wrong with a country that tolerates that? This was supposed to be a classless society, and instead it has created an aristocracy by bequest.
Well, and that's sort of what we're fighting for right now with what's going on this stupid fiscal cliff thing, is they are going to fight, and the representatives are going to fight, and they will put everything up against the wall so that these people don't have to pay an extra 3% of tax. They should be paying an extra 30% of tax.
Right.
Until this national debt, which mainly came from, Reagan, Bush 1 and Bush 2. And, they made all the money off of it. Anyway, I didn't want to get into a long rant on this. I just, wanted to bring up the thing about, I just couldn't get past the fact that this presidential candidate who got, 48 million votes or something like that, close to 50 million?
47, actually. It's kind of ironic.
47 million votes. And this is the type of activities he was involved in. That 47 million people in this country would actually vote for someone who was that wealthy and, frankly, just that strange. And it's just a little scary to me. I don't know.
It's more than a little bit scary. And of course, it plays to a certain extent into how we view Barack Obama. And, to the extent that we're all sitting here waiting for the other shoe to drop, waiting for him to cave in to Boner and decide that Social Security and Medicare recipients are going to have to pay for the excesses of Wall Streets and stock speculators and liquidators like a Romney. Well, consider for a moment, and this is not an excuse for any of that, but there, we wouldn't even have to wonder with President Romney, and the stock of Meow Mix would have gone through the roof.
Absolutely. Well, I just saw on the computer yesterday that Obama had told Boner something about, well, since you didn't go for the 400,000 cap on on wages or whatever, that it goes back to 250. Is that true? Have you heard anything?
We don't know. As President Obama walked away from the podium, all the reporters were screaming questions at him, and he just walked away. So they're playing it all very close to the vest, and nobody's going to find out anything until they've got something that they can really screw us with good.
Well, I don't have a whole lot. I just wanted to comment on that.
Well, I mean, do you have any? I don't say this as a criticism, just a function of reality. Do you have any confidence in Harry Reid?
No, I don't. What's sad, though, like I say, back when he ran against that woman, I can't even think of her name right now, but it was...
Oh, Sharon Angle? A chicken to the doctor?
Yeah, and, let's get rid of Social Security right now. Some time ago, like I told you, my only hope was in voting for him was that he seemed to be one of the few people that said, you're not touching Social Security. And I mean, I know there's a lot of things, and a lot of people here hate Harry Reid, and they don't like him, and blah, 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 but gosh, how many politicians really are standing up and even saying that with any power? But when you have to put your eggs in the basket with Harry Reid, I don't know. It is scary, that's for sure.
Well, but it was a couple of years ago that he acknowledged that maybe he should have listened to some of the members of his caucus who were begging for filibuster reform. And now we find ourselves back at the beginning of a new Congress here in just a few days, and the same filibuster reform movement is underway. And is he going to support it? I don't know. And I asked that question about, do you have any faith in any confidence? I hate the word faith. Do you have any confidence in Harry Reid? I wish I could say resoundingly yes, that it, by God, he's a fighter, he's a battler. There's no way he'll let himself be run over. But hasn't he let Mitch McConnell walk all over him for a few years now?
Yes, but then again, look what he did with his own, one of his own faith in the Mormon faith with Mitt Romney. He stuck his neck out on the line and went right after him, saying that he didn't pay any taxes and put up or shut up. And, that was pretty strong when we were to think about it. Now, I don't know if that was something personal within his own, within his own faith, within his own church. And don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to stick up really for Harry Reid in many ways.
No, I understand your point.
But when you're looking at someone, unfortunately, and I really hate to say this, like our current president, who I voted for twice, and the ink's not even dry on the election, and already, we have to work with these people, and I'm like, I'm just banging my head against the wall. Just the thought of even voting again makes me sick. Someone who's voted all their life, you know what I mean?
I know.
Like I said, I don't want to keep you, but I'm curious. I'll be curious if anybody else has anything more to say about, Mr. Romney stepping in at the deathbed of a ultra wealthy 14-year-old. I mean, that is just, that's I would have to describe that as ghoulish behavior myself. But
I think that is a more than appropriate term.
That's something that people like you and I and most, I'm sure all the people who listen to this program, we can't relate to and never will be able to relate to. That's behavior that is beyond even comprehension. But anyway, go ahead and get on to the rest of your callers, and I'll be listening in, and have a good weekend.
All right, you too, Carol, and Happy New Year to you.
Same to you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. From Vegas, that's our buddy Carol, and I just wish we didn't have to sit here and worry. And just as a sort of thought experiment, if we can put ourselves in that time, or if that time will fit into this one, if FDR or Harry Truman or John Kennedy were engaged in this problem, would we be worried? Or would we know that a Truman or an FDR would sit there and say, no, you're not touching Social Security? Would LBJ have tolerated this assault on Medicare? See, the fact that Medicare has any problems at all, in large part, stems from the fact that LBJ's hope was originally, if I understand correctly, that Medicare would be expanded until it was eventually universal single-payer health care. It just didn't work out that way. A note coming in from Jan in the UK. I do not think, she says, it is only the right-wing families in your country who got their money by corrupt means, as in mine. By not being fair, you're being as bad as the right-wing radio. And I take that very much to heart. And I'm going right back to the phone, by the way. So stick around if you're on hold, please. Lines open, 304-658-3333. Generally speaking, few are those who can amass great wealth without doing great evil. It's just that way. I'm looking here because there is a very relevant quote that speaks directly to this issue.
comes, oddly enough, from a Raymond Chandler novel. Well, I'm not going to sit here and make you listen to dead air while I look for it. We'll go to the phones, and maybe I'll run across it somehow. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, honey, Bob. This is David out in San Francisco.
Well, hey, David. Good to hear from you. Been a long time.
Yeah, it's a long time. As a matter of fact, I just wanted to let you know, too, in going on to the Head-On website, it comes up with this strange thing that says that it's a site that'll guaranteed give you a virus or something like that. So
yeah, we've been dealing with that all day, and Ben and John are on it. We have been attacked again.
Oh, well, you know how they say rage against the dying of the light. So
yeah,
it's something to do. Hey, well, by the way, before I start, I was going to say happy Yalda too. Are you familiar with Yalda?
No.
Well, apparently anthropologists have discovered that the oldest holiday in the history of humans is Yalda. And that's when they figured out that the days were starting to get longer. So happy Yalda.
Well, very happy Yalda to you, too.
Yeah, this is before they figured out that the sun revolves around the earth. So all they knew was the days were getting shorter and the days were getting longer. So this is about as primitive as you get as a holiday goes. Hey, you know, I heard your previous caller there, and he was talking about the Romney wealth and whatnot, and I don't know if he's ever read any Richard Condon, but Richard Condon is a great author. He wrote Prizzi's Honor and Manchurian Candidate and any number of different books that were really dynamite about the aristocracy and organized crime. They were always like fictional accounts of these various wealthy families, like Vertical Smile and Winter Kills and whatnot. These books would describe, if I remember right, Vertical Smile was about this guy that inherits this massive amount of money, and his father just like beats his obedience into him, you know, going to the select private college. And all this kid wanted to do in his whole life was to be a dancer. But he became like one of these evil, rapacious Scrooges that kind of ruined the world. And Richard Condon's just this great author. He puts everything right into perspective and gives you something to work with as you're trying to muddle the affairs of the world. And if he ever gets any chance to go down to the used bookstore and check out Richard Condon.
Well, I'm writing it down myself.
Yeah, he had all sorts of great titles in there. And one other thing, are you keeping up on the LIBOR scandal?
As best I can. I get cross-eyed real easy, David, because it's not necessarily my métier, if you will. But yeah, I keep up. I have done what reading I could when I saw stories come across.
Well, it's basically pretty pretty simple. LIBOR is where the world's interest rates are set. If you remember back to Jimmy Carter days, Carter lost the election because interest rates went from home loan of about 3% and 4%, all of a sudden in the course of about 2 years went up to 22%.
I remember those days.
Yeah, it was just insane. There was no logic to it. And so basically what happened was under Reagan, LIBOR was created in 1984, and it was to be this, the 18 largest banks in the world were going to submit financial data on a regular basis, and all of this data would go into a common pot, and then the average interest rates would be set for mortgage rates, for credit cards, for business loans. All of the interest rates of the world were going to be set by the LIBOR. Well, people have suspected forever that these numbers were fraudulent, but with email now, it's now been proven that these things have been frauded. And the second largest bank in Switzerland, UBS, was busted last weekend,
mm-hmm.
was forced to pay $1.5 billion in fine for one charge, and they've committed 800 charges against them. And so they've admitted and fessed up to one charge, and they're claiming that there were only two guys that were involved in the whole thing. But there were, when you start reading these emails, it makes it very plain that they were setting these financial, they were submitting fraudulent data in order to jack the interest rates on everybody. And so when you look at the idea that Greece is bankrupt, or Spain is bankrupt, or that Social Security is bankrupt, or Medicare is bankrupt, it's all fraudulent because it's based upon LIBOR numbers.
It is. It is in the sense of the legal term, it is fruit. It's all fruit of a poisonous tree.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And you know that when they talk about LIBOR, they're talking about potentially a $500 trillion fraud. Not $500 billion, but $500 trillion fraud, because these are bond issues that run out 30 years and things like that. And in fact, to give you an example, out here when the Bay Bridge collapsed in the 1989 earthquake, the first bids to fix it were, you know, potentially a half a billion dollars or something like that, maybe in the simple couple of $100 million range. And by the time Willie Brown got done with it, it was going to be a $6 billion repair job with a $6 billion financing. So it was $12 billion just to fix half of a bridge. So, and this is all based upon LIBOR kinds of numbers. These guys have been jerking us around probably since 1984 when the LIBOR was created. So, you know, the whole Occupy movement, the idea that basically if you go to Bloomberg, Bloomberg News, and you look up LIBOR and UBS specifically, they're running an editorial now that says that UBS should lose its corporate charter. Now, you know, if you were riding around in your motorboat smoking a joint, and the cops caught you and they busted you for it, they'd seize your boat. Well, if the U.S. government yanks UBS's corporate charter, that means that all of their assets are going to be seized. And this is, you know, the second largest bank in...
Do you see that as even a remote possibility, though, David?
Well, it's pretty unique to look at...
We've got an attorney general who participated in letting board members of Chiquita Banana slide, who admitted to knowing about and participating in and approving of murder for hire.
Yeah, death squads. And they never even tried to find the identities of who were pulling the trigger. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, there's some really ugly criminal people. But, you know, the basis of why I would say that this is a possibility is because when you start looking at $500 trillion worth of debt, that means that every company, you know, whether it's General Motors or whether it's, you know, the local rat catcher, they are all in debt unduly because of these fake numbers. And when you start looking at, you know, you start reading these emails. Did you ever read the Enron emails where they were actually laughing about?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. About getting Granny's savings retirement and stuff like that.
Yeah, she'd be living on the street and all this. This is the same kind of stuff. And so that they knowingly put Greece in hock, and that they're knowingly. This is the economic hitman kind of stuff.
Yeah, they burned Ireland to the ground.
Sure.
Yeah. Right.
So absolutely, it is completely viable, and so it's now more in who are the potential alliances, because virtually anybody that uses money is using jacked money, and whether we're going to have to go to a jubilee where we just cancel all the debts and start over again, or whether we finally seize the assets of all of these criminal operations, is what it's all about. Because there's just no, back to your previous conversation with the earlier caller there. When you start reading Richard Condon, or you start looking specifically at Oliver North, when Oliver North was wandering around, with a letter from the president saying, do what I say because he has this top secret deal and I'm the guy that's going to pass off this top secret deal and it's for the security of the nation, so you better do what I do. So he'd go on a military base and get a submarine or 89 TOW missiles or two jet fighters or whatever he got. and he would be able to disappear with them. He was then doing the money laundering through various banks. And BCCI was a famous one, but almost every other major bank was involved in money laundering due to Oliver North. And, in fact, many of the savings and loans went bankrupt, had to go bankrupt because they were following Oliver North's orders or, you know, his buddy's orders. And so even though it was pretend, you know, Ronald Reagan claimed he didn't know anything about it, and so Oliver North was, gosh darn it, just pulling a swindle using this letter. He, you know, the as far as the Senate inquiry was concerned, Oliver North turned $83 billion, and this was 40 years ago, $83 billion. So this was a massive amount of money. And the idea that, actually 30-something years ago, but this idea that this guy essentially forced all of these banks to do criminal operations, and the people that performed the criminal operations have now gotten into the habit of continuing with the criminal operations. And so we can take it straight back to Oliver North. I mean, this guy, well, it's really older than him, because if you read Catch-22, you can see it's, you know, probably 50 years before Oliver North. But still, the point is still there, that with the security state, you know, the some letter from the CIA or some guy that comes in with a badge and says, we got to do this swindle to catch some other bad guy. And not only do they never catch that other bad guy, but they end up running off with the assets of the bank. And the bank can never admit it because they're sworn to secrecy. So you can see where this swindle, they use the security state to perpetrate a fraud. And so, yeah, it's interesting because Richard Condon kind of lays out some of these in simpler form, but he talks about them in the Cold War standards, and Oliver North was actually pulling them off. So it's very interesting, and that's why Jubilee and yanking the assets and just, you know, if you remember back in the 20s, 1929 and probably the 30s, when they were doing the farm auctions, and the banks would come to seize the land and they'd try to auction off the land, and the various people at the auction would crack heads of anybody that put in a bid, and then they would buy the farm at a dollar and give it back to the guy that had it. That's basically what we're going to have to do, because these guys they're so criminal that, you know, they've swindled everything of everybody on the planet. You know, LIBOR is not just in America. It's in the entire planet. Anywhere that uses financial transactions via the International Monetary Fund are subject to LIBOR. And so they've swindled the entire planet, and now they're playing everybody against each other. You know, playing them against each other with religion or with, you know, ethnicity or you know, every kind of bigotry that they can use, they're putting those up as the shams to keep everybody divided and conquered. But keep your eye on LIBOR. It's basically not very confusing. It's actually simpler than you might imagine, but it's a simple swindle which has affected everybody in the world.
Well, there's no doubt of that. And as you were talking about $12 billion bridge jobs and stuff, the place where my head begins to spin is, and I don't even know if I can enunciate this, where was the $12 billion worth of value? And I guess I have trouble with that, because I understand paying working people a living wage. I understand that all the way to my toenails. I understand the cost of materials. But somewhere along the way, I have a feeling there were a couple of Ferraris tucked into that. Does that make sense?
Oh, big time. And as a matter of fact, you're absolutely right with most of the allegation, because if we were stuck with this fella here. Maybe you've heard of him. His name's Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
And,
of course I have.
Yeah. Arnold was the governor while the biggest part of these swindles were going on. And he basically was the one that, I don't know how to say it, but he was the one that basically signed the contracts to make sure that they went through. And even though there were a lot of activists here in the Bay Area that were furious about not only the rising costs of it, but that the actually the spans of the bridge were done in China by sweatshops. So where you would think they would get a cost savings, they actually the profit margin was even higher because they outsourced the manufacture of the biggest part of the spans to China, and so those weren't even done by unions, even though they're done, you know, currently there's unions up in there. The actual span development was done by outsourcing. So we can thank that to Arnold. And there were a lot of, the entire California legislature was fighting about that, and we had a bunch of pack of crooks in the California legislature that were doing basically what's going on in the U.S. legislature, where they just filibuster and pull these swindles on the votes. And so that's how it came to be that high. And, you know, our Willie Brown was deep in the deeply involved in it. So it's, you know, that's why I have no respect for Democrats or Republicans in the main, because Willie Brown was as corrupt as Arnold. They're just two peas in a pod, and you know.
And whether it's Arnold or Willie Brown, and whether it's a sort of sad, grasping personal venality, or even something larger. The question, you know, it seems like, you know, this is an onion. It's layer after layer after layer, until you get to a place where, for instance, the dodge at LIBOR or the credit default swap scheme reaches a level where only those who are actually running the hustle understand the hustle itself. Now, I think you're right. I think LIBOR, for instance, is a somewhat more easily comprehended hustle than credit default swaps and all that went with the housing bubble. But at the end of the day, the schemes are such, are they not, David, that even the most brilliant of individuals has a hard time defining the whole universe of it. Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, well, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, this goes back to...
And that makes it harder to stop, and I think it's by design.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm in my 50s, and I remember when I was young, contracts were all written in gobbledygook, and watch out for the fine print, and don't let them get you drunk before you sign it, and all of the, you know, the standards of signing a contract, you know, read it four or five times before you even consider signing it. And so there was a big movement during the 60s, 70s, and 80s to simplify contracts, get them to be readable, get legislatures well aware that what they're signing is something that's serious. And, you know, as time has gone on, I'm noticing that they're getting right back into these very twisted logic. And when you start looking at derivatives and the various financial instruments that are being drawn up, there's a lot of scandal about smaller counties and towns and regions that are getting suckered into, you know, sewer boards that are ending up buying, a pipe and materiel for extremely high dollar, when all they'd have to do is shop around a little better to get better quality and better price. And it's as if the newly elected people are played against each other as if they're Democrat and Republican, versus somebody who can actually do some shopping around and get the best deal, whether they are Democrat or Republican. Because, you know, outsourcing, you know, the jobs, making your state a right-to-work state is not bringing money into the region. It's setting it up so that money can be sucked out. And, you know, for people to claim that they're loyal to the Democrat or Republican parties and just facilitate the magnetism of money away from a region is what's surprising about this. You know, to see $12 billion be spent on a bridge is one thing, but then when you realize that half of it is going to be financing to some offshore bank, and the other, you know, some large portion of it was in the manufacturer in a sweatshop in China, then you're getting into who's getting the, I'm not sure if you're familiar with what were called the derivatives, but those were basically the opportunity to milk the money while it's in the hopper. And so the idea that if you...
Yeah, it's the same thing as the guy in Godfather 2 who says, I just want to wet my beak. This was was the beak that was stuck in the pond. Yeah, I understand that part of it.
Yeah, yeah. And so the whole idea that we as so-called civilized people are falling for some enormous, frauds that are, they're basically easy for a baby to spot. And the idea that we continue to get suckered by them is kind of amazing. How we would, it's kind of incomprehensible how an educated population could continue to get suckered by something that was so simple. And nothing new under the sun, I guess. So, hey, well, I'll let you get going. I'm just happy Yalda, and we'll see you next year.
All right, don't be such a stranger next time. I really appreciate the call, David.
Well, I check in all the time, but I don't often call. It's I've been in a whole different kind of schedule, but with any luck, things will change.
All right, wonderful. Well, you take care.
Good week.
You too. Bye now. David, calling from San Francisco, and going back. Well, I think this all works within the same framework. I mentioned a Raymond Chandler quote. For those of you who have never read Raymond Chandler, The Big Sleep, The Lady in the Lake, it was once upon a time thought to be some sort of pulp fiction. But no, there is the writer's art on display here. And this quote, going back to what Jan wrote a few minutes ago, is from The Long Goodbye by Raymond Chandler. There ain't no clean way to make $100 million. Maybe the head man thinks his hands are clean, but somewhere along the line, guys got pushed to the wall. Nice little businesses got the ground cut from under them and had to sell out for nickels. Decent people lost their jobs. Stocks got rigged on the market. Proxies got bought up like a penny weight of old gold. And the five percenters and the big law firms got paid $100,000 fees for beating some law the people wanted, but the rich guys didn't. On account of it, cut into their profits. Big money is big power, and big power gets used wrong. It's the system. Maybe it's the best we can get, but it still ain't any ivory soap deal. What do you think of that? Now, that's written in the late 40s. And it's within the context of a detective story. But that's the kind of thing, if you're a really brilliant author, you can tuck into a detective story and get people really thinking. There ain't no clean way to make $100 million. And those are $100 million 1940s bucks, so they're probably billions now. But think about that in the context of the America that the Green family of the Hobby Lobby loves. $70 million without so much as the bat of an eyelash, as long as Richard Roberts credible disappearing act. Sneezing not even, barely a sniffle at the idea of a $1.3 million per day fine. We're talking about money that has a lot of zeros behind it, and I think the Hobby Lobby conduct is not that far removed from the sort of parasitic banking conduct that David was talking about. Because the way that Hobby Lobby grew is by, what does Raymond Chandler say here? Somewhere along the line, guys got pushed to the wall, nice little businesses got the ground cut from under them. This all sounds so much better, sort of Bogart-esque, and had to sell out for nickels. Decent people lost their jobs, stocks got rigged on the market, proxies got bought up like a penny weight of old gold, and the five percenters in the big law firms got paid 100 grand fees for beating some law the people wanted but the rich guys didn't. You reckon, where do you reckon the money for the, oh, what was it called? The Beckett Fund. Where do you reckon that came from? You think that that's just contributions coming in from little children throwing dimes into collection plates at Sunday school? Because I'm guessing it's not. I'm guessing that's some Coke money. And some, well, you reckon they'd be out there representing the Green family of Hobby Lobby if the Green family hadn't done some donating too? Darlene wrote in a little bit ago and brought up the Koch family when I brought up Stalin. Weren't the Koch brothers' father, wasn't he engaging with the enemy at the time, Stalin, made his multi-millions drilling oil for him? Just like Prescott Bush colluding with Hitler to make his millions. I can't recall, Darlene says, the industry he was engaged in or what he was selling to Hitler. Well, Prescott Bush was part of a banking outfit. Oh, there they are again, banks. Called Brown Brothers Harriman, and they set up this dummy shell outfit called Union Banking and Trust. And Union Banking and Trust was the captive financier for a guy named Fritz Thyssen, who was known for a long time as Hitler's angel, for having provided the financial wherewithal for the rise and reindustrialization and remilitarization of the Third Reich. And yes, Darlene, you're absolutely right. The Koch brothers' daddy did business with Stalin, and I think he came away from the Soviet Union and Stalin thinking he had been somehow cheated out of a nickel or two. And at that moment, and only at that moment, and not a moment before, did he become a rabid anti-communist. He was just a businessman when he was over there doing business with the communists. But when he didn't get paid in a timely fashion on one of his invoices or whatnot, then he became a rabid anti-communist. You see how it works. Right. So I take Jan's criticism very seriously, and I hope I've answered it. Yeah, there's nobody out there sitting on a 9-digit pile of money, or a 10 or 12 digit or 13, 14 digit pile of money, in which every dollar came in ivory soap clean. Maybe it's the best we can get, but it still ain't any ivory soap deal. Yeah. Big money is big power, and big power gets used wrong. Well worth remembering. Let's go to Skype. Sandra's with us. Hey, Sandra.
Hey, Bob. Can you hear me okay?
I got you.
All right. I was just talking about this fiscal cliff madness. I'm just amazed that people seem to forget that this arrangement was created by the debt ceiling in a way, supposedly to force the hand of the Congress that created it to do something about the so-called debt. So they've had a year to deal with this because they created it themselves. And now we have like all the, you know, the sort of courtier media, you know, fawning about and acting as if this is really something organic that's happening. I mean, and even these so-called liberals are falling, are toeing the line too. And I just don't think, you know, Americans really understand that if they get what they want, no matter what deal it is, they're going to reduce the discretionary budget to like Eisenhower type of numbers. And that would leave us with a government that is a social insurance program and a garrison, military. And everything else is going to be cut, you know, to the bare bones. And honestly, a country of 330 million or so, you can't function like that. And for, you know, people, I don't think people really see what's coming. This is the politics of taking things away.
It absolutely is. I mean, I haven't particularly focused on the story because it just sort of, it just slipped away in the midst of other topics. But the idea that come January we're facing $7.50 a gallon milk, not $7.50 a gallon gas, which is probably where the price should be, but $7.50 a gallon milk, because we can't get, you know, because government has reached a state of absolute stasis.
But the thing is, I get sick of these, you know, the so-called our side even engaging in this, because we've already lost the war, because they're both talking about austerity budgets when we need to be expanding the role of government, because those jobs aren't coming back, so you have more people who need the safety net, not less.
Oh, absolutely. The story from last night out of Slate about welfare payments in Georgia. Under the scenario you described, Sandra, everybody gets to be Georgia now. You know, where they've got thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people desperately in need, and less than 4,000 people who actually receive temporary assistance to needy families payments.
And, you know, like that little story that came out of China, you know, I think Mike Malloy might have touched on it, but it's so true. It's like, you know, the U.S. used to do stuff like that, you know, like the 1,500-mile-long bullet trains. I mean, those are the sort of projects that we used to be known for, but we have no one in government with a vision of anything. All Obama talks about is treating government like a household and entitlement reforms. I mean, he's truly disgusting at this point, because he doesn't offer any kind of vision at all. We're arguing over a 3% hike in taxes on the people who have, like, destroyed the economy for the rest of us, and we gotta cough up the rest of the safety net. I mean, he's begging, coming out with that shit. It's incredible to listen to.
Well, it's intolerable going for any, like you said, for a nation of 330 million people. But I keep coming back to this thing. I mean, yes, I agree that I think Barack Obama tipped his hand. You know, I would have been a Republican in the 1980s, I guess. You know, what he said to that Miami TV station. But he wants entitlement reform. The other side wants to burn the place to the ground. And when those are the two ends of the spectrum, there's nowhere in the middle that's safe, Sandra.
No, but see, I just think it's a cop-out, because there's no reason why Obama can't come out and make a bold statement about what we should be doing and have the GOP answer back. We're not getting that from him. And that's my problem with him. I understand what you're saying. There is no downside, because he got elected to protect the safety net. People didn't vote in November for him to fucking put up the safety net on the block. I'm sorry. I don't see that. I don't see that in anybody I speak to.
No.
You know, they don't, that's not what they signed up for.
Well, even Salon this afternoon was offering up an article that said the last minute deal is the worst possible deal.
Well, of course it is. But for him to keep harping on it and not, you know, sort of coming up with, you know, something a bit more bolder and expansive, as a, it's just, it's, to me, it's borderline criminal because they've already gave everything to the 1%, and they're not representing us in any way, shape, or form. I mean, I'm just sort of, you know, I really don't have anything else to say about it. That's it. I just am sort of gobsmacked that.
Well, no, I hated that line because I watched the little statement right before we went on air, and he said, and of course we've got to figure ways to cut spending intelligently or meaningfully. I forget exactly what adverb he used.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
But why? 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 Why?
That's what I'm saying. It's like he doesn't say anything that will move the country forward because cutting it will just, we see that. All we have to do is look over in Europe. We see what, how that works. I mean, it's not like it's a mystery and it's not a mystery to anybody. Yet here we got the largest economy in the world, at least for the time being, is going to do what? They're going to offer up an austerity budget that's going to match what they spent during the Eisenhower administration? We can't do any better than that, Bob. Are you kidding?
No, no. No.
I mean, I just am sort of...
Well, that begs the question, you know, cuts. I really would like to know. I mean, I'd love to sit down and say, no, okay, enough of these platitudes. What do you mean when you say cut spending? What kid needs less food to eat? What mother needs less access to prenatal care?
Well,
because that's included in that cut spending BS.
Yeah, well, that's discretionary. Like I said, anything outside of the military and the social insurance program, Social Security and Medicare, is discretionary budgetary concerns.
Yeah, Medicaid.
And
Medicaid.
They want to, right, Medicaid, education, R&D, you know, hurricane warnings, any kind of energy policy. I mean, all that is discretionary, and they want to annihilate that. I mean, it really doesn't make any sense. And if people really understood what the options are going forward for the country, they, I think, would be a fair bit upset, you know, because, I mean, it's incredible what, yeah. You know, what they're proposing two years from now, what we're going to get. I mean, who knows? And I don't really trust Obama as any sort of leader with any kind of vision to do anything at this point. I'm just like, damn, you know, you're working real hard to do your entitlement reforms. And all you hear from our side is, oh, he's going to cave. It's not caving anymore at this point.
No, this is behavior according to type, is it not?
And also, I don't know if you missed it today, but, you know, they extended that FISA bill without any consideration whatsoever for the privacy of us citizens. So now it's like open season, and they can spy and continue to spy on us at will.
And I think taken together, Sandra, we get to start asking a question. And this is, you know, this is not the kind of question that teabaggers who like to go back and fawn over the Declaration of Independence and so forth like. No, what do you do when government becomes absolutely non-functional?
Well, we know what we can do. We even have an old-ass document that tells us. I mean, you know, I'm not a huge Thomas Jefferson fan, but, I mean, his shit was pretty right on. And the option he gives in that document holds true today, okay? And, you know, but unfortunately, you know, we're being sort of entertained to death because, I don't think people even have a clue about self-governing anymore. They've let it go and turned it over.
And, you know, the conversation has come up again, and again, you and I have had this discussion, and I don't ask this rhetorically, Sandra. You know, we generally just have a generalized conversation going on here, but sometimes it's nice to think in terms of how would we fix things if we could. Your generation, my generation, is, going back to a conversation I had with Jim a couple of nights ago, you know, we're on the table with an apple in our mouth. Because the, I really don't think they want to come after the current recipients of Social Security and Medicare, but we're a prime target because we're a member of that, we're a member of that generation, that demographic, that is being heartily entertained to the extent that we're not working our asses off. And who, you know, who steps up, who leads, who says this is unacceptable at a level that that these disconnected, disassociated, almost disembodied spirits in Washington, D.C. listen to? And I don't know the answer.
Well, I mean, I
hope some of it is still sort of bubbling away out there inside the Occupy movement, but I don't know that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, but the thing is, all our institutions that we appeal to are, like, beyond our reach, because the media is just atrocious. I mean, you have this person from the Washington Post, Marcus, I forget it, Ruth Marcus, talking about, oh, I guess they can buy, if they can't afford steak, they can buy chicken, i.e. cat food. You see, I mean,
right.
They don't care. Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid don't apply to these people who are reporting on the palace, the Versailles. You know, and...
Right, because it's got a hall of mirrors in it, and it goes on forever, right?
Yeah, there's nothing to do, you know, so they don't... You know, it's just... I just fear, I really fear over the next 4 years, the sort of... the level of damage that's going to be done to what's left of the New Deal. I mean, it was called the New Deal for a reason... And now the elite, they obviously don't need us anymore. That needs to be sort of stated. They don't need us to save them anymore. And they're acting accordingly.
And, I mean, that's a bitter pill. That's hard to face and harder to swallow. And I mean, I know way down deep inside what some of the answers are, and some of the answers that are way down deep inside are not things that I would even say out loud.
Well, a lot of it involves, you know, lamp posts and rope for the elites. I'll be honest with you.
And yeah,
What do we do
to get their attention? You know, these people who eat chicken instead of Chateaubriand.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm just saying, and also, at the end of the day, their solutions don't work, too. That's the thing, you know, and it's kind of like with politics, when people get power, it doesn't mean they're going to do the right thing. They get power and they have horrible ideas. And the only way it's put in check is if they have to satisfy millions of people, like the U.S. is. You see what I mean? They have to accommodate millions of people, you know, hence Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So,
I'm also at least historically cognizant enough to know that things get awful sideways in an awful hurry when the whole world, goes down the toilet. And, you know, you, We will take the world with us.
Oh yeah, I mean I'm not.
And I mean I'm not talking about nuclear missiles, at least not right off the bat. But a worldwide economic collapse that is that becomes sort of a feedback loop and is self-sustaining leads countries to think crazy things and do more violent ones. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, well I mean I think that the sort of simmering conflict between Japan, the third largest economy, and China, the second largest economy, over some rocks, is something that we all need to pay attention to, because as we know, war starts over some of the damnedest things, don't it?
Oh yeah. By the way, did you see this? And granted, I read anything from the UK Mail Online with a jaundiced eye.
I know, but that's becoming, that's fast, that's becoming, that's fastly becoming my favorite paper. I know what you're saying, though.
But did you see this story about the woman in Oregon opening her Halloween decoration?
Oh, no, I missed that.
So this woman had bought some plastic gravestone decorations for Halloween. And she goes to open it up, Sandra, and she unwraps it all. And, you know, you mentioning China. You know, China, on the one hand, launches this bullet train that's the, well, it's the envy of me. But on the other hand, a woman goes to unwrap her Chinese-made graveyard decorations from Halloween that she had bought at Kmart that had been made in China. And she unwraps the two headstones, and tucked between the two headstones is a letter. Now, the thing was all vacuum-wrapped and sealed and everything. It wasn't, it didn't look, you know, it's kind of hard to dummy this situation up. The story was originally reported, and she's from Oregon. The story was originally reported out of the Oregonian paper out there. The set was something called Totally Ghoul. Eerie graveyard light and sound set. And so she opens this thing up, and then she unfolds this letter. And the letter reads as follows, Sandra. Sir, if you occasionally buy this product, please kindly resend this letter to the World Human Rights Organization. Thousands of people here who are under the persecution of the Chinese Communist Party government will thank and remember you forever. This product, produced by Unit 8, Department 2, Mashanja Labor Camp, Shenyun, Liaoning, China. People who work here have to work 15 hours a day without Saturday or Sunday break and any holidays, otherwise they will suffer torturement, beat and rude remark, nearly no payment, 10 yuan for 1 month. That's about $1.60 a month. People who work here suffer punishment 1 to 3 years averagely, but without court sentence. Many of them are Falun Gong practitioners who are totally innocent people. Only because they have different belief to the CCPG, they often suffer more punishment than others. This is the level of desperation that workers in China have gotten to. They're literally a message in a bottle.
And they think that's for real?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way to absolutely verify it, but they checked with a couple of human rights organizations, and they said, oh, yeah, this happens.
Hmm. Well, I mean, you know, it's just sort of slave labor, and I mean, the whole thing is just...
But remember, we want to bring those jobs back from China.
Well, I mean, I'm still queasy about that Apple person talking about them wanting to, you know, make some Apple products here, and then that rumor that Foxconn is going to be built in Detroit. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Those are not going to be good union jobs.
No.
But doesn't that Foxconn rumor sort of play nicely into understanding why that right to work got rammed home right lickety split?
Yeah. Oh no, that's what I'm saying. That's why it's just, you know, beyond creepy. And another thing I just wanted to mention, and I'll let you go, but, you know, I know the Newton thing, you know, it's beyond horrific. We know this. I don't even, it's sick. It's hideous. But it's, you know, it's interesting that they have raised $3.4 million, for the families there, you know, and, the outpouring of, you know, whatever a normal person would do to deal with this situation. But if I can just say that, you know, you have children gunned down all over this country all the time.
Day in and day out.
And the network saying that, oh, it wasn't supposed to happen here. And you're like, well, where is it supposed to happen?
Bingo.
You see, you know what I mean? I'm sorry. I'm like, the commentary, I mean, people need to check themselves before they open their mouths. Because you're like, okay, if it wasn't supposed to happen here, my next thought is that, well, you mean that it should happen where? You see what I mean? When they open their mouth and say stuff like that, you're like, well, you're
yeah, where is it acceptable for it to happen? And what
right.
that, but see,
and you know where it is acceptable.
Yeah, because I mean, I translate that kind of stuff as, well, we weren't paying attention to all those other children who were getting killed. That's okay.
I mean, and yeah. Anyway, I don't know. I just that just
no. That's along the same lines as that idiot woman Charlotte Allen, who wanted the huskier 12-year-olds. To rush shooters,
yeah,
but they didn't do it because Sandy Hook Elementary was feminized.
Yeah, oh, I know, but no one talks about that. You know, laws are put in place to afford no liability for these gun makers. They can make their armaments freely. And the cost of doing business is everybody's fucking children.
Yeah, I got a little curious the other day, and just as a, well, actually it was earlier today, and started going to some online gun sales websites like, you know, Uncle Bud's Guns or whatever it was. And everybody is out of AR-15s. You can't buy one in Walmart in West Virginia. All the Confederacy states, everybody, they're gone. You can't get them because they're being bought faster than they can be manufactured. I mean, that's the reality. That's the on the ground fact. That's the aftermath of this yet another Butcher's Bill horror, is that these damn things are good for business.
Well, and not only that, but you have, you know, this is. I mean, I don't mean to be obtuse, but this is yet another example of the kind of virtual corporate state, you know, because they buy off the politicians that create the laws to make it an environment where they can sell their murderous goods, and then they buy off the propaganda arm to convince dumbasses that somehow this is attached to the Constitution.
Yeah, and like I mentioned last night, I don't know if you heard or not, but this thing that I was made aware of, this rumor that's flying around here in West Virginia, that that because of the fiscal cliff, no one's going to get their tax rebates.
Oh, yeah. See, that's just, yeah. I mean, and you know, when people don't have a clue about history or anything, you'll fall for any fucking thing. I mean, I know it's a cliche, but it's so true, because how many times in U.S. history, every other decade or every 5 years, we're at this point? It just happens over and over and over again, and people just keep falling for it because they don't know that it happened just the other day. I mean, it's crazy.
I mean, from an economic standpoint, and I struggle a little bit because I want to phrase these questions in ways that they make sense, but are we, if things continue on their present path, and I understand, you know, that it's not a fiscal cliff, it's a gentle slope. I think Lawrence O'Donnell refers to it as the fiscal curb. But is this a level of dysfunction, Sandra, that does lead to the end of things? And I'm not talking about Mayans or Jesus coming down or any of that silliness. I'm talking about just what happens to a government that can no longer do its business.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, I have no idea, because you know, with this sort of level of perniciousness on the part of the corporate state, I mean, It's really sort of overwhelming our government at this point. You know, it's incredible, because we just had an election, and that sentiment has dissipated, and we're replaced with this BS where they want to impose austerity on the largest economy in the world at this moment.
Right. Where are the people in the streets?
Anyway,
because I think realistically, if we were talking about I mean, if we were 4 weeks from now and this was going down under the new administration of President Romney, don't you reckon there would be a call, and every progressive who could walk or roll or be pushed or carried would be in D.C. protesting?
I don't know about that, because unfortunately the line is so blurred now since we've had 4 years of fake Democrat. You know, I do think that weighs on what kind of response it will be, because I don't know. Maybe so, Bob. Maybe you're right about that. But,
well, I think that represents a little bit of cynicism on my part. But
you know, I'm not too sure. I just think that there seems to be some things that are baked in right now that are really disturbing. I remember years ago I forgot what article talking about how the trajectory of the U.S. is to reduce living standards by a third.
But that's the living standards of everyday Americans, and that's not the living standard of the standards of the lobster for lunch crowd.
No, that's right. And you know, having stagnant wages for 30 years is a good start there. But it seems like Obama is almost handpicked to sort of manage the decline or the ushering in of this kind of new serfdom. I don't neo-feudalism, and I know it sounds dramatic, but if you're not going to generate jobs for people, I don't, you know, how do you expect to broaden the tax base?
And we've got the larger inquiry of what do we mean by jobs? Because when we were talking about cuts a little bit ago, you know, when you said we're going to be down to nothing but non-discretionary spending, like the Pentagon and Social Security, okay. But if, for instance, one of those odious things that we on the so-called left talk about periodically is that idiotic boondoggle, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter.
Oh yeah.
You know, that thing needs to go away yesterday.
Mm.
But how many jobs go away if it goes away?
Well, no.
You know, I mean, we are so far down the rabbit hole in Faustian bargains that we can't see straight.
Well, yeah, it's like more toys, less boys. Isn't that the formula?
I do believe you're right.
Yeah, but the thing is, and that gets me to that whole Hegel thing, which is disturbing, because you know his background is disturbing, but some of the other people that they're going on about is equally disturbing, because I forget the woman's name that they're considering. She's like a handmaiden to the defense contractors. That's her whole song and dance. So before all these liberal women get excited about some bitch being the head of the Pentagon, they need to check themselves, because she's a nightmare. I can't remember.
Well,
the
there is no gender guarantee. Look, there's no gender guarantee that just because one is female in an office that one will somehow be less ruthless.
No, but when you combine that with, you know, Obama's Blackface Act and you put women in there, you know, these people on the left just lose their minds. It's like, you know, take a step back and see who the hell these people are. I mean, I was laughing when the log cabins put that ad up about Hegel, and we're supposed to get all vaporized, all upset about, you know, his anti-gay so-called commentary. But you should be more upset about how Obama seems to just put names out. They're not even nominated, and they're completely annihilated, and then he just moves on to the next. I don't know how he gets anybody who wants to be in his government with that sort of a process. It's quite disgusting.
I mean, you know, Lisa Jackson just stepped down from the EPA too.
Bye.
Yeah.
Don't let the door hit you.
But what? And this is always the question. Yeah, what corporate shill? You know, are we going to get a mining executive maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I can't wait. But no.
Or maybe no. I mean, no. The mountaintop removal's not sexy anymore. You know, dead hillbillies, so what? No, maybe we'll get a fracking executive.
Well, you know, what, next year is 2013?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Obama will still be president when, what is the one prediction that that just alarmed me, was that the ice will just be totally gone from the Arctic in the summer of 2015. You know, I mean, I those sort of milestones, I mean, is that not a bit worrying for you?
No, it's a lot worrying for me. And even the New York Times, bless its little heart, came out and said fostering a conversation on climate change is not enough, Mr. President.
New York Times. Gruesome.
That's the problem. We've had enough conversation.
Yeah,
I mean, I mentioned last week sometime this book that Jeff Biggers highly recommended. It's a very short book, very easy read, called Clean Break by Osha Davidson. And I finished reading it, and I'm hoping we'll have a conversation with the author sometime soon. But it's all about, you know, how Germany accomplished what it did with its energy plan. And then you look at how we can't. And it sort of feels like, you know, what I said earlier economically about the planet, that, you know, we sneeze and the world gets the flu. You know, there's a certain coterie of individuals who are willing to burn the global economy to the ground, and that same coterie, Sandra, is willing to burn the planet to the ground.
Well, also, I mean, you know, I don't know about you, but the whole idea that by the year 2030, the U.S. will be totally energy independent and sort of a new Saudi Arabian petrostate is a bit of a worry.
because
you know, we're going to... opposite direction with that, right?
Yeah. Well, none of that's sustainable. I'm watching this huge, underreported Native First Peoples movement that's developing in Canada called Idle No More.
Mm.
There's some real momentum going in Canada among Native peoples who are tired of being run over in the name of energy independence.
Well, yeah, no, that's definitely, and they got good reasons too, because Harper is destroying all environmental checks, I mean legal laws, and turning that country into a petrol state. And it's incredible to sort of look at what he's doing. But do you know about this massive oil gas disaster in the Baton Rouge, wherever it is right now?
Oh yeah,
Assumption Parish.
Yes.
I mean, hello. The hell does that look like?
That's where the big hole in the ground is, right?
Yeah, but it's just getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
It's like eight. I don't know how big it is, but it's bubbling. It's bubbling up, and they have to evacuate folks and. The authorities, I'll say that in quotes, they don't really know what to do. And this is what we're supposed to be excited about coming to
a town
near
you?
Yeah,
that's our bold new energy future, Sandra.
Right. And, so,
and what, did you see the thing earlier today where the eight sailors sued TEPCO?
Oh.
Eight sailors from the USS Ronald Reagan have sued the Tokyo Electric Power Company.
Because they're getting irradiated?
Because they say TEPCO lied to them when U.S. forces, especially the Navy, went in to assist after the Fukushima disaster, and that TEPCO assured them it was safe when, in fact, they were being marched into into a radioactive nightmare.
And they need to turn right around and sue the U.S. government because I'm sure they told them the same damn thing.
Well, the first thing that went through my mind was that I wonder how long it'll be before the Justice Department steps in and says, no, this suit has to go away.
Well, exactly. I mean, isn't that always, I mean, yeah. I mean, we're back to that virtual corporate state. But listen, the only other thing I wanted to mention, which was just incredibly sad, is that poor woman died, the one who was gang raped in India, you know.
Oh,
what
Jesus,
is, right?
yes.
Yeah, she just died tonight, and it's just kind of like,
what was the response, Sandra? Well, if she hadn't resisted, she wouldn't have gotten raped as badly.
Well, there have serious instability around this shit, though, which is, I guess, overdue. But, you know, they don't have no answer for the rape culture because it permeates probably three quarters of the damn globe.
Saw another story about a woman in South Asia who killed herself rather than be forcibly married off.
They told her she needed to marry off one of them. Yeah.
Meanwhile, though, the usual suspects, and you know where this one's going, a priest in northwest Italy, Father Piero Corsi, put his church message out on a bulletin board, and the church message church apparently consisted of suggesting that women invite rape by how they clothe themselves.
Right.
Italy has 118 women murdered in the past year alone in domestic violence alone. That's the highest in Europe. And the title of the Christmas message from Father Corsi was "Women and Femicide: How Often Do They Provoke?"
Oh no! Well, yeah. I mean, it's just horror. It's just hideous that poor woman, both those women, you know, are dead. I just, you know, it's just the whole. And that poor woman was just riding on a train with a male friend. Too.
Yes.
I don't really have any comments. I just wanted to let you know that because I was.
No, I knew. I knew she had died.
Oh, God, you know. Anyway, this was a really ever so cheery conversation. So I'll tell you that I made my first batch because I got this food processor for Christmas.
Yeah.
And I made my first batch of hummus. And boy, nothing tastes better than like fresh hummus.
Oh, the fresh stuff, yeah. And if you go the next step and get the dried chickpeas, garbanzo beans, and rehydrate them and cook them yourself and then make the hummus.
Yeah, that's what I did.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, you're working the gold standard.
Yeah, it's outrageously tasty because of that. Oh, no, I went the whole route. But now I'm thinking, you know, because you can put anything in it, you know. I just did a simple garlic lemon juice.
Yeah, I mean, the way I go. I mean, there's nothing better than the original, you know, warm, steamy pita bread to go with it. Yeah.
Right. And I put a little paprika on top.
Oh, yeah.
And right now I'm eating it with some sort of wafer cracker and cucumbers.
Oh, man. That's good eats. That'll work.
Yeah, I'll leave you with that.
Sounds good. It sounds good. Any big plans with the twins for New Year's Eve or anything?
Oh, you know, I'm funny you should mention that because I'm looking after them because I can't be going out with the madness. So
no.
We'll probably play some sort of board games and I'll let them stay up past midnight if I can stay up myself.
Well, at least we don't have Dick Clark to kick around anymore.
Oh, you know what? Stop. That's like a horror. That's like some sort of Walking Dead type.
That was just mean of me, and I know it.
Yeah, but it's too much. It really is too much. Anyway, okay, well, listen, you have a good... are you having a show on Monday?
Oh, yeah, show Monday night and a giant Skype party group confab thing if you want to join in.
Oh, is the same handle?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
Or rather, shoot me a note, and I'll put you in contact with Sparky, and he'll add you to the group.
Oh, okay.
And it'll be everybody and their cousins. It'll probably be huge.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, have a good weekend.
All right. You too, Sandra. Bye.
Bye.
Fresh hummus made all the way from the dry beans up. Yummy. A couple of emails before we go back to the phones, and a reminder, we are still $50 away from meeting Don's end of the year challenge. He's got $100 out there that he will use to match the first 100 that comes in here. 50 of that got taken care of in one swoop, at leaving 50 more between now and midnight December 31st. But it sure would be nice if it happened, you know, maybe before shows end or by midnight, you know, here December 28th. Going back to the mailbag real quick, Don, who issued the challenge, with a couple of comments. Bob, you mentioned how Hobby Lobby should just form their own church. I kind of wish they would. The Church of Hobby Lobby. Maybe that would help America take a good look at the whole tax-free status of religion in general. If a corporation wants the same exemptions from health care laws as churches, then they should be restricted from political speech. And according to recent Supreme Court decisions, political speech equals money. So logically, corporations should be restricted from making political contributions or political speech contributions. But of course, that logic does not apply, Don notes, because now tax-free churches are growing more defiant in the restriction on political speech. The right wing irrationally uses fears of Sharia law being introduced in America for their own destructive agenda, but they work so damned hard to implement their own warped version of it. With regard to Raymond Chandler, and the quote I read a little bit ago, Don said, Chandler knew the score and reported how it was obtained. Perhaps the greatest American 20th century author, and very readable. Nuances layered with metaphors wrapped in unmitigated reality. That's the way I feel about it. Andy, with regard to the Magnitsky Bill, heard you yesterday talking about the Magnitsky Bill. Couldn't agree with you more concerning adopting Russian children in America. You'd think any government that has an inkling of what's happening in the U.S. would not let their children, their country's future, take a chance on this brutal, ruthless, and vicious working-class environment. Also, December 22nd, New York Times, Kerry in role of a lifetime is pick, referring to news conference comments from Mr. Obama, climate change would take a backseat to the economy, at least for now. You can forget about this fossil fuel shill in the White House doing anything to rein in drill baby drill. That's why I'm real nervous about who's going to replace Lisa Jackson. A fracking executive would be fitting, don't you think? And Randy says, hey, Sandra, homemade salsa is next and real easy in that food processor. Thanks, Randy. On to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
This is Edward.
Well, hey, Edward.
You've made me hungry talking about humus.
Mm-hmm.
I have some in the refrigerator right now. And I serve it with pita bread.
Oh, absolutely. Nice and warm, too.
Oh, yeah. We have a wonderful called All World Grocery Store or something like that, and you can get all of those chickpeas and everything there. Just fantastic.
Oh, and I love all the Indian breads, too. Have you ever tried any of those?
Me, too. Well, I back in my younger days when I was a university person, I had a lot of Indian students working for me, and I got lots of recipes from them, and they were just wonderful. Anyway, I hope you're having Hop and John on New Year's Day.
Absolutely, and cooked cabbage. We try to cover our bases here.
Absolutely, because you got to have the greens with it, because that's money.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I'm going to a New Year's Day brunch, and I'm taking the Hop and John.
I bet you it's going to be dandy. What do you do for yours?
What do I do for mine?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's see. It's got bulk hot sausage in it, onion, and green pepper, and chopped celery, and garlic, chicken broth, rice.
And black-eyed peas.
Hmm?
And black-eyed peas?
Of course.
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord, yes. I asked my grandmother why it was called Hop and John, and she said, well, she says it's so good when you taste it, you'll hop all the way around the table. And I thought that was rather nice, but I've been trying to research it to find out where it came from, and the closest I can come to it is a Creole word of for black-eyed peas, which is pois, went right out of my head. Oh, pois pigeon.
Well, I can see how we could get from there to Hoppin' John in a hurry.
Well, I think so, too. Well, enjoy your Hoppin' John, and have a happy new year.
I'm going to try real hard, and you too, Edward. Take care.
I certainly will.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Bye now.
Bye.
From Dallas, our buddy Edward. Yeah, we do the cooked cabbage and the hoppin' John here just because it's, you know, two different traditions and don't want to offend any of the local deities. A long time ago, David in Tennessee taught me a way of doing cabbage that was just wonderful, where you steam it and some carrots and some onions, and then with a little bit of oil in a hot iron skillet, saute it real quick with some a little finishing of balsamic vinegar or lemon juice at the end. Whoa! And ever since then, that's the only way the gang around here wants the cabbage done. Hoppin' John. Hoppin' John GK in the chat room. Like Edward said, some onion, some celery, some hot sausage, rice, black-eyed peas, done up with chicken broth. Yeah, right tasty. So a reminder, as I was mentioning to Sandra, we will have it's just going to be a veritable Skype Horn Malloy chat hoedown on Monday night. We will be live for New Year's Eve. Sparky will be moderating it. If you've never been on the Horn Malloy chat on Skype and you want to get involved, shoot me an email and I will pass it on to Sparky. And of course, like I said, no, I'm not looking for that word. We're rather, Waggy, we are rather hoping it won't be that word. It's a word that begins with, it's one of those compound nouns. Cluster, yeah, duck. No, it was pretty successful the night of the election return, so I think it's worth taking a second run at it. As long as everybody's got good mics and speakers and everything, it tends to work out pretty well once we all learn to talk one at a time. It should be fun. Just regular time, New Year's Eve. I'd like to extend it. I was talking a little bit with Kevin about that last night. I don't even like to be on the road after sundown on New Year's Eve. But I do have to, I think, take the boy to some sort of, yes, adult-supervised teen New Year's Eve party. And I think that'll preclude me from being able to be on the air any longer than the regular show hours of 9 p.m. I don't know. The Skype chat will probably go on long after. We'll play it by ear after 9 p.m. Let's put it that way. So, let's see. Where do we go from here? Oh, I know. Let's see. Yeah, women cause rape by the way they dress. Thank you, Father. May we have another? Ignorant Puke in Kentucky has a dummy with an Obama mask on, an Obama face, eating a piece of watermelon. That's Kentucky for you. There's a poll out now that shows that Ashley Judd, in a hypothetical race against chinless Mitch McConnell, only trails him by 4 points. Libertarian ophthalmologist Rand Paul has been trying to do his part in carrying some water. He recently declared that Ashley Judd, who opposes things like mountaintop removal and domestic violence against women and, you know, rape, he said that she is too liberal for a great state like Kentucky Stan. Really? Mitch McConnell is actually beginning to sweat at the prospect of facing Ashley Judd. You know, she lives in Nashville in Scotland. She's one of them Nashville, Scotland liberals. She's too liberal for Kentucky. 4 points. 2 years away. You reckon Ashley Judd, who holds a master's in public administration from the John F. Kennedy School at Harvard, you reckon Ms. Judd could close 4 points in 2 years? I can't think of anybody in the Congress I would rather see replaced, not even John Boehner, than Chinless Mitch. Lord, who's his assistant? Who's his Renfield? Who would follow him if he got ousted as minority leader? But you just know that fellow who put up that Obama effigy there in Kentucky. You just know that's your diehard Mitch McConnell voter. The fellow said when they asked him if he thought the watermelon was racist, "No, it ain't racist. I thought the dummy might get hungry." Nice, huh? No, that story I shared with Sandra a few minutes ago, I want to go back to that for a minute. Imagine how much risk was involved for some slave in a labor camp to try to sneak that letter out. In a Halloween ornament package. $1.61 a month in a prison labor camp where people are literally worked to death. So that we can buy, yeah, and this set, it's a couple of plastic faux stone crosses with RIP on them, and then a tombstone itself with RIP and the robed visage of grim death upon it. Gotta figure this thing was at least $20. Eerie graveyard light and sound kit. And these were made by the millions, transported across China to a shipping port, put onto a container ship, sent across the Pacific Ocean, unloaded at the port of Los Angeles, put on trucks, and distributed to Kmarts all across the country. It's totally ghoul. And it carried in it plea of an incredibly brave slave laborer, written by hand on notepaper, promising that if this note could just be put into the hands of the World Human Rights Organization, that the people working and dying in the slave labor camp will thank and remember you forever. And in that culture, forever is a very long time. They will suffer torturement, beat, and rude remark. stuffed into the labor camps without any court process whatsoever. Man, you gotta love that free market, don't you? $20, $25, $30 for some molded plastic crap that was bought time and time and time again through the Halloween holiday season. The production costs of which were probably literally pennies. The shipping costs of which were probably greater than the cost of production. And coal mines in Australia, Indonesia, Appalachia, and China itself go to power the electric power grid that produce these cheap molded plastic pieces of crap that are made by slaves. And we call that globalism. And we don't even have this Christian nation, the morality necessary to mark such garbage as this as being made by slaves. A 1 to 3 year sentence that often works out to be life. The China director at Human Rights Watch, Sophie Richardson, told the Oregonian that it was impossible to absolutely confirm the origin or authenticity of the letter. But she said, "We're in no position to confirm the veracity or origin of this. I think it is fair to say the conditions described in the letter certainly conform to what we know about conditions in re-education through labor camps." China's re-education through labor is a system of punishment that allows for detention without trial. Masanja labor camp is located in the industrialized capital of the Liaoning province in northeast China. Sophie Richardson said, "If this thing is the real deal, that's somebody saying, please help me, please know about me, please react. That's our job." And next Halloween? Well, production is probably underway for all the millions more of these things that have to be produced by next year. Can we even call something like this an economy? Because it feels more like a vicious robbery of human rights and human dignity. Email coming in from Darlene. "Is it my imagination, or has the Catholic Council of Bishops been deathly silent regarding the Newtown, Connecticut tragedy and the need for strict gun control laws and improved mental health services? Weren't they hopping mad about Obamacare and health insurance coverage for birth control and getting all worried about the unborn, the fetuses, as you say? I haven't heard them screaming from the church rafters about what happened to the born, once vibrantly alive children who lost their lives in Newtown, and everywhere else in this country, for that matter, as Sandra reminded us, due to violence. Have you?" No, no, no. Nor do I expect them to say anything. You know, when the Pope uses his Christmas Day message to declare that marriage equity is the end of the world, what do you expect from the guys who work for him? Jack in Shreveport writing in. If we can believe that people would jump to their deaths at a Foxconn factory in China, then it's not outlandish that we believe what was in the letter you spoke of, Bob. No, it's not. It's just another day in the capitalist miracle of relentless consumption for relentless production within a system that cares not a tinker's damn about human dignity. And that's a fact. So I guess we find ourselves at the end of this Friday on the front porch. Thank you for some great conversations. Thank you for the help that we have had in reaching fundraising goals this evening. We're halfway there to Don's challenge. And the challenge will continue even after the show. Let's work one more phone call in right quick. Hey, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
Hey, what's up, Jim?
Well, I went to come on my laptop and nothing would come up, not even the icons or anything.
Really?
Yeah, isn't that fun?
Not my idea of a good time, but...
It sounds like a hard drive problem, Bob.
Oh, dear. I hope not. You don't need that.
I've already gotten a new computer, but I can't get it to work yet because I couldn't get Sunlink to get in there and give me the access code.
Oh, brother.
Just wonderful.
I know. We've had problems with the website this evening, so yeah, I get that. All set for New Year's. Anybody come by to bring you your recliner? Or did the check arrive?
I'll let you know. So what's been going on tonight? Oh, well, it's time for you to go almost.
Yeah, it is time to get out of here. But it's been an interesting evening. Great conversations.
Good.
Yeah. Well, Jim, have yourself a good weekend, and hope you'll be joining us for the conversation on Monday evening. We'll be here.
All right. Take care.
All right. Bye now. Good luck with the computer. Seems like they're the computer demons are on the march this evening. All right, let's get out of here. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. Thanks to our all volunteer staff. Thanks to Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to Agnes for help with the show post. Thank you to John Fox, who has been going at it hammer and tongs this evening. There may have to be a 50% raise in there for you, John. Thanks to Ben Birch. He's been at it, too. WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AICACT.org. A whole new push for the AIC Act will be starting with the new Congress, and I hope you will be a part of it. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith is on the way on the horn.